Junior Tinmold included some searching questions about 20-mile-an-hour zones, health spending, and government spending on water and electricity infrastructure. We'll hear these questions and more shortly, and later, Speaker of the House of Keys, Ewan Watterson, a former Junior Tinmold member, tells us about the importance of this annual sitting. But first, Lawrence Skelly has brought the court to order for the last Junior Tinmold questions of the 2025 sitting.
I'd like to ask the Minister for Health and Social Care what her department's plans are to overcome financial impact on Manx Care of a projected shortfall in national insurance.
Call on the Member for Health and Social Care to reply.
As political member of the Department of Health and Social Care, I'm happy to be answering on behalf of my Minister. The national insurance contributions paid to the Department as a contribution to the operating costs of Manx Care, known as the NHS allocation, is not affected by the size of the Manx National Insurance Fund. It is instead based on the amount of national insurance contribution received in the tax year. If the national insurance contributions received in the year was less than expected, then the National Health Service allocation would be less and the reduction would be made up from general revenue, which is generated from income tax, VAT and other income. If the contribution income was more than expected, the extra NHS allocation would reduce the amount of general revenue income needed by health and social care. The national NHS allocation is a contribution towards the cost of running the health and social care service, but it doesn't meet the entire cost. For the 2025-26 financial year, the NHS allocation is £71 million from the NI Fund, which forms just part of the allocation to Manx Care, which this year has a total allocated budget of £361.8 million. So you can see the NI contribution is about a fifth of that amount. The difference between the net running costs of Manx Care and the NHS allocation, as I say, is met from general revenue and other receipts. This year, that amount of funding to Manx Care is just shy of 291, plus the 71 million, which brings us to the current budget that Manx Care has been offered for this year.
We got to question 12, and if I can call on the Honourable Member for Council, Mr Bell, to ask his question.
For the Minister of Infrastructure, what plans there are to make public transport more accessible and affordable for people aged from 16 to 20 inclusive?
Call on the Member for Infrastructure to reply.
I'd like to thank the Honourable Member for their question. Bus Fanning operates a safe and efficient bus service to both residents and visitors to the island. Reduced cost travel cards are currently available for individuals aged 16 to 20. Go Easy cards allow 28 days of unlimited travel at a discounted rate on any scheduled bus vanning service and half price on our night owl service. The card requires an initial payment of £5 and may be topped up with additional funds as often as desired. The following products are available for this age group: the Go Easy Teen 5 to 17 years at £40 and the Go Easy 18 to 21 years at £60. Go School cards are also available for those in full-time education up to 19 years of age to travel to and from school or college. The department is always looking at ways to enhance service provision, which includes accessibility and affordability, both of which will be themes covered in the forthcoming bus strategy. This strategy, which takes into account the results from the consultation undertaken last year, will be published by the end of this year.
Supplementary, Mr. Malloy.
Thank you, Mr. President. Will the government extend universal half-price bus tickets to all school-aged people, not just those under 16?
Member to reply.
I think that is an absolutely excellent idea, which I'm more than happy to take back to the department.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
Could the Minister advise what plans does the department have to improve public transport access for rural young people who currently have no service at all? And will the department consider travel grants for those excluded from the current network?
Member to reply.
Good
my HRA. Travel grants is an interesting concept, not something I think the department has previously considered. Like I said in the answer, the department is working on producing a bus strategy, which I think will have to take into account accessibility. So in the north, for example, we know that not all of our rural communities are particularly well served by the current bus service, and that is also true of other parts of the island that are more rural in nature. All of these things will have to be factored into the bus strategy, which, like I said, will take into account all of the results from the consultation that was undertaken last year, and I will be happy to provide that feedback to the department as well.
On to question 13. I call on the Honourable Member for Council, Mr. Hickman.
I'd like to ask the Minister for Infrastructure why the government believes that proposed 20 mile an hour speed limits are a good idea.
Call on the Member for Infrastructure to reply.
My Electorate, and I would especially like to thank the Honourable Member for this question. The Isle of Man government believes that introducing proposed 20 mile an hour speed limits in certain areas is a sensible and forward thinking step to protect residents and visitors alike. Many of the island's towns and villages have narrow roads, limited pavements and shared spaces where pedestrians, cyclists and vehicles mix closely. By lowering speed limits to 20 miles an hour in residential zones, near schools and in busy village centres, the government aims to reduce the number and severity of road accidents, helping to save lives and prevent serious injuries. Evidence from other communities shows that slower speeds create safer streets, especially for children, the elderly and other vulnerable road users. This aligns with the Isle of Man's commitment to improving road safety and promoting a sense of security for everyone. Lower speeds also encourage people to walk and cycle more often, which helps reduce traffic congestion and supports healthier lifestyles. In turn, this benefits the island's environment by lowering vehicle emissions and improving local air quality. For the Isle of Man, maintaining its reputation as a safe and welcoming place is vital for residents' quality of life and for tourism. Calmer, quieter streets make local high streets and village centres more attractive to visit, which can boost local businesses. Overall, the proposed 20 mile an hour limits are not about restricting drivers unnecessarily, but about balancing the needs of motorists with the well-being of local communities. The government believes this change will make the island's roads safer, greener and more enjoyable for everyone.
Supplementary, Mr. Malloy.
Thank you, Mr. President. Can I ask what, if any, influence did similar changes made in Wales have on this decision? And if not, what independent research was carried out into it?
Member to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Again, I'd like to thank the member for that question. This actually came from an instruction from Tynwald Court, so there were several debates spanning a number of years around the introduction of 20 mile an hour speed limits as the default in residential areas. This started, I believe, with a motion from the Honourable Member, Mr. Shimmins, back in 2019. This has been going on for a while. Ultimately, the instruction government has received has come from Tynwald Court. Tynwald Court said, go away and do this. They didn't say go away and research it and compare alternatives. They said go away and do it, and the government is exercising and implementing the will of Tynwald.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
Can the Minister explain why the Department believes it's appropriate to include the main arterial route through Colby and Ballybeg in the proposed 20 mile an hour speed limit rollout? Given this is a key route in my own constituency, and the Minister has previously stated that arterial routes will not be included.
Member to reply.
The way the roads were initially determined was based on a set of criteria that has been published on the government's website. There is a website, 20mph.gov.in, if anyone is interested in the detail behind all of these proposals. That is very much a start of a 10 to begin the consultation process. The consultation exercise in the north has just opened on the plans for roads in the north, and that will include some arterial routes, for example, the Zaire Road through Ramsey and up Bowering Hill. The intention, I think, is to get local feedback and to hear exactly from local residents on whether they think these are good ideas. I'm expecting my constituents to tell me we probably shouldn't be slowing down the speed through the main TT route through Ramsey. I'm expecting residents in the south, when the consultation opens on the 3rd of November, to tell us the same thing about arterial routes in the south. The department is committed to listening to that feedback, to taking it on board, and the message I would give people is look at that website, provide feedback, make sure your friends and family and other people living on the island do provide consultation feedback when we go out and talk to them, because ultimately that is what's going to inform the department's decision making on which roads eventually become 20 miles an hour.
Final supplementary, Mr. Hickey.
In a recent letter from the Chief Constable, he stated from the 1st of January to the March 2025, out of 118 casualties on Manx roads, 1.4 of them were in these 30 mile an hour zones that are currently being declassified to 20s, whereas a whopping 75% were on national speed limit roads. Does the government believe that it's got the focus of this speed limits wrong?
Member to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Again, a really sensible question to ask, and I think if we were doing this purely on a road safety basis to reduce road fatalities, you would probably remove our national speed limit. I don't think that is what Tim Ward wants us to do. I don't think that is something the public want us to do. Tim Ward has very clearly instructed the government to go away and focus on residential areas, areas around schools, areas where there are shared spaces. That has been the focus of this work. And ultimately, if it will save 1.4 lives or 1.4 fewer accidents in these spaces, I think that's worthwhile.
Now we move on to our final question. Call on the Honourable Member for Garth, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. President. My question is whether the island's housing, water and electricity and infrastructure are sufficient to cope with the rising demand and the population growth.
Call the Chair of the Manx Utilities Authority to reply.
Insofar as water goes, Manx Utilities has a comprehensive strategy to ensure a reliable supply of clean water to meet the needs of our growing population. Our interim water resources management plan, which is published on our website, outlines how a secure supply of treated water will be made available for Isle of Man residents over the next 40 years, setting out how this can be achieved by supplementing supply with realistic demands in reduction. Insofar as wastewater goes, we are focusing on improving systems to manage wastewater sustainably and effectively whilst supporting a growing population. New works have been designed with appropriate headroom in accordance with area plans. Additionally, construction has already started on the Peel Regional Sewerage Treatment Works, which will further enhance the island's capacity to manage wastewater. The catchment of Garth will be the final step in removing raw sewage into the sea around our coastline, and that is good news. Power. Regarding power, it is interesting to note that our island's power demands have been reduced by over 20% since the modern power station at Pool Rose was commissioned in 2003. This means that the power system as a whole has enough headroom to accommodate population growth, although Manx Utilities will be required to generate electricity in different ways if the climate change targets are to be achieved. There is a current focus on the introduction of renewable energy sources like wind and solar power, together with ways to repurpose existing assets. Overall, Manx Utilities believes that part of the solution would be for everyone to use less water, for us all to be more efficient in the ways we use electricity. Thank you.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
Is the Manx Utilities Authority using its limited financial resources wisely, or is it at risk of prioritising unrealistic schemes like the Kervai Wind Farm, whilst failing to properly invest in the essentials, like upgrading the electricity grid to take private connections, fixing sewage outflows into the sea, and ensuring essential services are in place for new housing?
Chair to reply.
Thank you. The short answer is yes, we are losing our resources responsibly. This last month, we've announced a new subterranean reservoir up in Jerby. Every year, we extend our water network piping system by 12.5 miles. That's without taking into account the bursts. We are forging ahead with the regional sewage treatment systems, as I've said. We're cleaning up our marine life. So I would say, absolutely, we are spending every pound as if it was our last.
That was the final questions from this year's Junior Tynwald. So what was former Junior Tynwald member and now Speaker of the House of Keys, Dewan Watterson's assessment of this year's sitting? We've just heard on the programme the final few questions from Junior Tynwald. Junior Tynwald this year was a lively affair, wasn't it?
Well, it does tend to be lively because the difference between Junior Tynwald and the regular sittings are we tend to know where each other are coming from when we have the regular sittings of Tynwald. You know the other members and you know what their agenda tends to be. And there's an element of predictability to that. But Junior Tynwald, well, not only are the gloves off, but we don't know where they're coming from either. So it really does make it quite an exciting bit of a political discourse, really.
And I suppose added to that, the junior members are not perhaps as constrained by standing orders. I mean, they're supposed to follow standing orders, but you know, they're given a lot more leeway than normal. The senior Tynwald would have.
Absolutely, we definitely want to give the young people leeway in terms of standing orders because it's not really about the procedures of making fair decisions. This is about hearing their views, hearing what they've got to say, hearing what they've got to ask, and getting the answers to those, because it's one of the few opportunities that, that young people get to engage directly with parliamentarians on subjects that they are interested in.
And you, of course, famously were a junior Tynwald member.
Yes, it's got a lot to answer for, hasn't it? I did junior Tynwald back in 1997 with another girl who had no political ambitions, Beth Espy, and we took a motion to junior Tynwald, and that was what got me started down this path. So yes, it's got a lot to answer for, but I have to say I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got sat between Sir Charles Carouche and Donald Gelling, asking a load of interesting questions about how the Isle of Man was run, and that passion's just never gone away.
Gosh, those were two political giants of their day. Indeed. As well. Yeah, and do you remember what absolutely. The motion was?
It was about whether the Isle of Man needed an energy from waste plant.
Gosh.
At least that's one issue that we got sorted. That was a really interesting debate. And of course, the debate tended to be a little bit less about whether we needed it or not, and more about where we would put it. So it goes to show that sometimes junior Tynwald is a good reflection of the rest of Tynwald as well.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, at this time of the year, the assumption, and it's a shame really that this assumption is still out there, but the assumption is that because you no longer are being broadcast on Keys and Tynwald sittings, that MHK's basically get the summer off. That really is not what happens, is it?
No, I mean, I think to understand the role of an MHK, you realise that the time that we spend in House of Keys and the time we spend in Tynwald is the tip of an iceberg. It's the very visible tip of that iceberg, and there's an awful lot that goes into even just those parts of it. The committee meetings that build up to motions from parliamentary committees, for example, that work all carries on. But it's only the bit that you tend to hear on the radio that we all get judged by. And that is a bit unfortunate, really, because there's a huge amount of research and preparation that goes into all the motions that that are put down by members, but also the contributions that are made by members to other people's motions as well. And that doesn't happen overnight. That happens over a long period of time. And this happens at some point. It tends to happen at these sort of times of year when there's a little bit less going on. So it is an opportunity to plan, to start to get ready for the coming parliamentary year.
I sadly, I did get over this. I remember fairly early on in my career as an MHK, bringing on our fortnight family holiday, and it wasn't actually in the summer recess; it was the TT fortnight. Mm-hmm. I brought with me the assisted dying report. This was back in Quinton Gill and John Rimmington's time. And it must have been about 2 inches thick, this report. Yes. And I brought it with me to read as my summer reading. So actually, you get an opportunity when you're not having the strictures of Tynwald sittings and Keys sittings. You get that opportunity perhaps to get your head round some of those more weighty issues that you wouldn't normally have time to set aside for.
You just give me a flashback to my first Christmas as an MHK in 2006, and sitting there, I think it was Christmas Eve, reading the Social Security papers, because I'd just become member for the day before getting into the new year. So that's brought back that memory. So thank you very much. But in terms of planning, well, I think firstly, the summer isn't as long as people seem to think it is. Tynwald doesn't meet in September, but we're definitely back at work in September. So the June to October isn't really a fair way of looking at it. So we're all the committees start up again in September. So really what we miss is August, in terms of we try to give the staff August to program their own holidays in and try not to have too many meetings during that time. So Public Accounts Committee, for example, we normally meet twice a month. So that's given me two afternoons back in August that I wouldn't ordinarily have. Also been developing a best practice guide for public accounts committees as part of my role in the Commonwealth Association of Public Accounts Committees. So been doing a bit of work around that, liaising with other people in Canada and things. Been doing a podcast for them as well. So there's bits like that that go on that you tend to sort of try and squeeze the time into. And then there's also the fascinating reading list. Just this morning, Manx Care have sent around the MIA governance review, and that's another 60-odd pages that we need to read, understand, digest, and see what needs doing with that. And that's a continuous theme of things that come out during the summer. And that's before you get on to the things that you'd like to read, like Tim Thornton's paper on the Isle of Man, Channel Islands, and statutes of the English Parliament to 1640, development and change in territorial extent. I know it's gripping, but it's all part of the background. If you don't study your history, you're doomed to repeat it.
I'm almost certain you were in council ministers when a chief minister who shall remain nameless came in and said, "Did anyone see the Scottish Parliament Standing Orders Committee on BBC Parliament at midnight last night?" Interestingly, no, we didn't. But I suppose the summer gives you a chance to get into your passions and interests to a greater extent. To a certain extent, Tinmulden Keys drives everyone's political agenda, doesn't it?
It does. And I wasn't in council ministers at the time, because I'm pretty sure that the chief minister you're talking about there was Tony Brown.
Right, it could be.
Tony and I still have interesting conversations about how standing orders work, even though we're supposed to be doing British Legion meetings.
Yes, I could well imagine. Final thoughts, really. You are now 4 years into your fourth term as an MHK. How have you found this 4 year period with the current crop of MHKs?
I think it's fair to say that it's been quite challenging, this administration. When I came in my first term, there were a lot of people around who knew the ropes, knew how it worked, both in government and in that sort of scrutiny world as well. And you could absorb a lot from that. And as time has gone on, the churn rate in the House of Keys in Tynwald has increased dramatically. And so we really struggle with that common understanding of the rules, the culture, the process of Tynwald and Keys. And that makes doing the business just that little bit harder if there isn't that common understanding. And that I think has led to quite a lot of friction in this term. And that's really unfortunate, because that's kind of wasted time rather than getting on with the business of, you know, improving the Isle of Man, which is what we're all there to try and do.
And is that potentially where a rethink on who you elect to Legislative Council needs to go on? Maybe go back to the days where you used to have quite a few former MHKs elected to LegCo.
And I think I think there's an acceptance that perhaps the baby was thrown out with the bathwater in terms of having no former MHKs in Legislative Council to bring that experience there. The thing is that because we've had that churn, there aren't really the available candidates coming forward who would be interested in that as a way forward. People who have come forward and thought, actually, the thing that I'm best at in this job is the legislation. I would like to therefore spend more time doing that, and a career in Legislative Council is for me. So that's a challenge. I think that there's a need for that, you know, in the next sort of 5 to 10 years going forward. Hopefully there'll be some that do specialise more in legislation. And whilst there's always the arguments about how we elect Legislative Council, I think the Keys have done a really good job in terms of identifying areas where, you know, perhaps we don't have the skills necessarily in the lower house and have filled those in the upper house. So, you know, seeing people with their strong IT backgrounds in Rob Mercer, or a social work background in Kirsty Morfitt, or international business with Gary Clewitt, there is just they're starting to those sort of skills gaps sort of fixed and using the upper house for that. And I think that's a fantastic use of that resource.
And from your own perspective, I mean, your manifesto would have no doubt been shiny and full of exciting promises. How do you think you're doing in terms of your manifesto pledges?
Well, one of the things I've campaigned on over the years about good governance in financial management. You'll have been sick of hearing me about talking about budget reform. There's a select committee ongoing about that. Whilst I'm a little bit sceptical still about whether the select committee on the budgeting process is really going to be the solution that I was hoping for, there is at least a conversation going on around that that there hasn't been before. And I'm really pleased that we now have an Auditor General, which, you know, best practice internationally, and looking forward to starting to report on some of those savings, identified savings that he's tasked with in the coming year. So it is quite an exciting time from that perspective. And I think that that is something that, having fought for it for a long time, I have really high expectations of delivery from that office in the next 12 months.
Well, go out and enjoy the rest of your summer holidays and have an ice cream for me.
Well, I'd love to say I'd love to have spent more time down Port Erin Beach, but if I can't, then I can only encourage others to do it for me.
And don't forget to get on that bus to Craignage.
Done it. Already been up twice.
Excellent.
Wonderful to go and do that. And it was, I think there were some tourists there that didn't quite appreciate what they'd just got.
That was Ewan Watterson, Speaker of the House of Keys. So what do you think? Impressed with the calibre of junior Tynwald members? Perhaps you agree with the text I received about last week's perspective. They were loaded questions, complete waste of my money. A bit harsh, but everyone's entitled to an opinion, I suppose. And while we're talking about opinions, let me know what you think by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Got a mayo. Thanks for listening.